This evening we'll finish in the book of Ecclesiastes. There are four different verses or groups of verses that we'll look at, and then next Sunday morning, God willing, I'll be looking at statements that include better for or better than that Jesus used, and we'll be learning truths that he expressed in this particular way of teaching. This evening, as we look at the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 6, we'll be looking, first of all, at verse 9, chapter 6 and verse 9, and I think I've already got this one farmed out to be read. Is that correct? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. We have a similar saying, and that is, a bird in hand is worth two in the bush, or a half a loaf is better than none. So what he's talking about is, if there's something that you can see with your eyes, take it and use it, appropriate it to your needs, because it's better to do that than to daydream about something that you may never get, that may never come within your reach. And therefore, it is better to take what lies before you day to day and use it than it is daydreaming and waiting for something to come along that may never get into your grasp. Again, it is like the saying that we've heard all of our lives, a bird in the hand, you can depend on that, you've got it, is worth two birds in the bush. And you might catch one of them, you might catch both of them, but if you turn this bird loose with the idea of catching two birds in the bush, then you may lose the bird in hand and you may lose the two in the bush so that you don't have anything. So it's just a way of saying, be contented with what's near you. Be contented with what's in your reach. And don't constantly daydream, because the Bible tells us here that this may end in vanity and in vexation of the spirit, which simply means it may never come to pass. And what you daydream, if it does come to pass, may have a lot of serious problems with it. You know, you may be living in the country and you may dream about living in the city. And so you spend a lot of time just thinking about how wonderful it'd be to live in the city. And one of these days, through your efforts, you get to live in town, and all of a sudden you realize that it's not what you dreamed it would be and becomes a serious problem to you. It might work the other way around. You may live in the city and dream of what it would be like to live in the country. And so you save and work and you live in the country and find out that it has as many problems as you left in the city. Live life not constantly daydreaming of what might come along and what may be a lot better, but take life as it is and use what is at hand. Now in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, there are a number of betters that are found in these 10 verses that lie before. So we'll not have someone read those, because there is so much material here. But we will ask someone to read Ecclesiastes 9:4, which will be the next place we go to. If you want to find that and be looking at it, you can read that. So let's look now at Ecclesiastes chapter 7. If you want to look at one to read, Ecclesiastes 9:4. But we'll read this one together and look at it together. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Remember that we're looking at life without any information from God. So if we look at life not knowing what happens to us after death, if the soul goes out of existence, if we're annihilated, then it's better because our birth is the beginning, and the death is the ending. And so the idea is that the day of death is better than the day of one's birth from the viewpoint of the vanity and vexation of life has ended. If we look at birth as the beginning of disappointment and dissatisfaction, and the death as the ending of dissatisfaction and anxiety and frustration, then the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. But a good name is better than precious ointment has a very simple kind of interpretation to it, and I think that is, it's better to have a good name than to smell good, because smelling good don't last very long, but a good name does, and just having on good smelling ointment is not going to benefit you near in the same fashion as having a good name. You can borrow money on your good name, but you can't borrow money just because you've got on good perfume or because you've got on a good aftershave. So the idea is that there's something more substantial and long-lasting in the good that comes from having a good name than simply from that which appeals to our senses. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. What he's saying is that in mourning there is more shaping of one's character than in the house of feasting. That we can have a great feast and all meet, we can laugh and talk, and we'll talk about perhaps a lot of frivolous things. But if we have a funeral and all of us come here to sit because some of our friends have died, and our conversations are apt to be more noble, and our thoughts are apt to be more sobering, and we're apt to think some thoughts that will affect us and help us more in the house of mourning than at the house of feasting, where there's just a lot of laughter. The heart of the wise, and he tells us why in verse 3, because sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. So the idea is that we choose to learn, and we learn more through our sorrow than we learn through our laughter. What do you think about it? What do we laugh about? What do we laugh about? Silly things most of the time. We laugh about jokes we tell or little things that happen to us. They're funny. But we don't really there's not much philosophy that's spun that is long-lasting or has what we'd call eternal principles that spring out of the house of laughter. But it could come from a sober heart and a sober mind. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. None of us like to be rebuked. I don't know of anyone who writes a letter to a friend and says, "Dear sir, or dear friend, I would like very much for you to rebuke me." I don't think we go to work driving on the freeway, fighting our way through the traffic with the idea that we can't get to wait there, can't wait to get there because we know the boss is going to rebuke us. I don't think we feel that way about school, and we just can't wait to get to school today because we know the teacher's going to get on us. I don't think we feel that way about home. You know, I just can't hardly wait to get home because I know that when I get home, somebody's really going to chew me out for something or tell me that I did wrong. This hurts us. It bothers us. But it is a way of correcting our behavior. So what he's saying is, it is better for us to hear a wise man point out our faults and failures and correct us than it is to go into the honky-tonk and listen to the Song of Fools, because we're not apt to get much information there that'll make us better as a person. He also states that when you listen to these people who are making their song, that is, the Song of Fools is like thorns under a wash pot, or like the burning of thorns. If you've ever done this, you know that they pop and crack and scatter the coals everywhere, and that they're quite dangerous, really, and there's no prediction at all to them. So burning in a fireplace wood that builds up a chemical inside of it until it's just a tiny explosion, and when it does, it pops the coals out into the room and burns the house down. What he's saying is, it's offensive to listening to this kind of just popping off and crackling sounds that have no predictability about them, that it gets irritating. And if you've been around a lot of people whose words of advice and whose philosophy of life has no more meaning to it than listening to the thorns crack as they burn in the fire, you've not learned much, or you're not that much better off. Surely, oppression makes a wise man mad, and a gift destroys the heart. And that is, a bribe destroys the well-being of a person, or whether you give it or whether you ask for it. And oppression makes a person insane. That is, things that are oppressive. So better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit, because the proud in spirit are going to constantly be what we would call put down. They're going to suffer from having their egos crushed. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. And I think the admonition is, don't always be bringing up the way things used to be, because they may not have been that way. The good old days may never have been the good old days. They may have simply been a time when you were not aware of a lot of other possibilities. And then again, we have a tendency to forget all the bad old things that happened in the good old days. We have a tendency simply to remember the good old days, but we don't remember all the bad things that happened to us in the good old days, and that's why we call them the good old days. But it irritates people if you constantly talk about, well, the church I used to go to, it was such a great church. Or the pastor I used to have, he was such a great pastor. Or from the pulpit, well, the church I used to pastor, they were great people. Or what I used to have from the viewpoint of my ministry, it was just the greatest people to ever live. And you have a tendency to say, if that's true, go back to them. You get tired of being compared to somebody that you don't even know and that you don't have any control over. And you sort of wonder, well, what's going to make this person happy? I can't call up the old days, the good old days, so we can live in them today. They're gone, so we can't live in them, so it's all over with. And so the idea of living in the past is not a very good way to live, because it creates a lot of tension, creates a lot of stress, and we don't live very well in the present when we're living in the past. Now, Ecclesiastes 9:4. Someone want to read that? I'm not paying anything for this now. And I'm not taking anything away from your paycheck either. All right, if you want to know why, the answer is in verse 5. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Now, if you look at a dead lion, he has absolutely no hope at all. But a living dog has hope. That is, he may get better. He may have a master who will feed him better. And so there is a possibility that for him, living could get a whole lot better. But for a dead lion, you know that things are not going to get better. But with the passing of time and with the increase of heat and bacterial action, things are going to get worse for the dead lion because he has no hope. Now, that's why a living dog is better than a dead lion, because while there's life, there is hope. The dead cannot experience anything. They know not anything. Doesn't mean that dead people in the grave don't know anything. He means that the dead, whether it's a dead dog or a dead human being, they cannot experience. They have no sensation. They have no emotion. Well, the living knows he's going to die, but the dead don't know anything. So a living dog is better than a dead lion, simply because for the dead lion, it's over. For the living dog, there's hope. I guess you can say that a sort of a contemporary statement, since we are aware of ex-president Nixon's death, I guess you could say that a sick infant is better than a dead president. Why? Well, he may not be president, he may not be wealthy, but at least he has some hope. That's just looking at it from the view of life without the Word of God revealing to us about the state of the dead or life after death or hope in Christ. We don't have any of this information. Well, a living infant's better than a dead rich man. So it's just looking at life without plunging down into the other things. Now in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 16, there are the rest of those things that consider one thing to be better than another. In chapter 13, he begins, "This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city and few men within it, and there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man." Now remember, here we're talking about achieving, but no one giving you credit. We're talking about the frustration of life and trying to get somewhere, but really never getting anywhere. That even if we get somewhere, when we get there, we realize we have to die and we're going to leave it all, so it didn't do us any good to get there in the first place. Very pessimistic view of life. So here's wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Verse 16, "Then said I, wisdom is better than strength." Now, but here's the city, very weak, and it's besieged by a great king, but there's a wise man in it, a poor wise man, and he develops a scheme or plan, and by this scheme or plan, the city is delivered. But look at that next sentence. "Yet no man remembered that same poor man." That is, they built no monuments to them. They might not have even asked what his name is. He just melts back into the crowd. "Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard." So it didn't do the wise man any good from the viewpoint of achieving any particular status in life. And again, wisdom is better than, as he states here, weapons of war. The words of the wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. You know, people may listen to you under certain circumstances. In fact, there may be a lot of credibility to what you say, and people may take your advice, or they may take your suggestions and then use them and have success. But the problem is, you're a poor wise man. No one wants to claim they've been helped by a poor wise man. No one wants to say that a poor wise man got them out of their trouble. So the implication is someone else takes credit for it. Or you just become that unknown man, that unknown person who found a solution to the dilemma, but you're never given credit for it, and you never get to enjoy it from the viewpoint of public acclaim. So again, wisdom is better than weapons of war because of what they achieve, but the people who use that wisdom that they receive from a poor wise man, who wants to say that he's the guy who thought up the idea? You know, people like to be delivered by a brilliant person. They like to be delivered by a massively muscular person with a great weapon of war. You know, we're besieged, and we see this huge group of people with magnificent army of muscles and weapons, and they deliver us. That's not harmful to our egos. We're willing to accept that because these are stronger people. These are trained people, and what we couldn't do, they could do. But here's a man who's despised. Here's a person who's very poor and might even be an illiterate man. A man can't read or write, and everybody's messing around trying to say, you know, wringing their hands, of my, what's going to happen to us? The mighty king, the city is going to be destroyed. And he just had some kind of simple little idea, and he said, well, if we'd all do so-and-so. And I'm like, oh, man. And they do it, and the great king wanders off out in the forest defeated. You know, nobody likes to admit that some real insignificant, illiterate person made a suggestion that saved the city. I know you've never experienced this. It's very unusual to me and my family, I'm sure. But you know, putting, you know, things together that you buy that some assembly required. Sometimes that's quite an understatement, isn't it? You ever like to be helped by your wife? I mean, you just tried and tried and tried. 3 hours later, it's just all confused in pieces, and it's just laying there. And you, with your great mechanical ability, some were just in between Wernher von Braun and the Wrights brothers, you know. And your wife comes along, she says, well, put this here and this here and these things here, and then you put this here and there. Don't it make you feel good? You just want to say, thanks, honey, you're such a bright person. Are you asleep? Hello? Well, what city, even a small city, likes to be delivered by a poor man who has no social standing, no educational background, and no mechanical aptitude? Just all of a sudden, just bare knuckle, he thinks of some dumb idea and it works. You know, have a monument erected to this guy? No. Forget him just as soon as you can, because it makes all of us look bad. He said, well, wisdom's better than a weapon of war because it got the job done, but there ain't nobody going to thank you for it. And you're not going to get the patent on it either. It's just, you did it, and it's over, and it's gone. Which is what? Vexation, vanity, emptiness, disappointment. So what else is new?